Michael Mann was is a more recent graduate from our atmospheric ocean group in G&G. He also worked for Barry Saltzman, but had contacts with other professors as well. Mike is well known in the blogosphere. He has single-handedly changed. I tell my students, my introductory students, that if they want to see how words can sometimes change their meaning, they should just Google the word hockey stick and see what pops up as number one. And very often when they do that, they find Mike's name mentioned. And I don't know if he's going to talk about the hockey stick, but if he doesn't, I urge you to do the same trick. Just try Googling hockey stick and see what happens. Mike is now at Penn State University, where he's director of their climate center there. Mike?
Well, thanks for that kind introduction, Ron. And I also want to thank the organizers of this event. It's been a real pleasure to be involved in this, and I'm looking forward to the remainder of the event. I am going to talk about how the study of climate change in the past, but not quite on the long timescale past that was talked about this morning, sort of the shorter time scale past of the past few centuries, how studying the climate change of over that time frame can inform our understanding of modern climate change. And in fact, I'll be, I think you'll see emerge again this theme that we've seen throughout today's talks of the importance of working both with observations and with theoretical models, and in particular how the marriage of these two approaches can often provide us more insight into the workings of the Earth system. This is, in fact, something that was very much instilled in us in our education in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at Yale. So let me start out by pointing out that indeed the globe has warmed over the past century. That's essentially incontrovertible. But as both Ron and Dorothy both emphasized, a lot of the interesting physics of the system is evident not in the average changes over the globe, but rather in the underlying spatial patterns of the changes that we see. And we can gain quite a bit of insight into the workings of the climate system by studying that spatial heterogeneity that we've been talking about. This is an animation of the GIS observations that Dorothy showed previously. And as you can see, the climate system is very dynamic. We see warming and cooling in the tropical Pacific. That's telling us about the El Nino phenomenon. We often see amplification of warming at higher latitudes, so-called polar amplification. And that's telling us something interesting about the feedbacks in the climate system. We often see these very large and opposite sign temperature anomalies in regions surrounding the North Atlantic Ocean, which is again telling us something interesting about how the climate system operates. Now, we have a fairly short instrumental observational interval to study the climate system. So indeed, as other speakers have talked about, we often turn to proxy records, tree rings. In the case I'm going to be talking about, proxy records like tree rings and corals and ice cores that have annual resolution. And so we can literally look at year-by-year changes in the past, several centuries to potentially a millennium or more into the past, given the array of records of this type that are available. And back in the 1990s, my collaborators and I published this reconstruction of surface temperature patterns in past centuries based on these sorts of proxy data archives. And what we were most interested in was indeed the coming and going of El Nino in past centuries. How frequent was the El Nino event? Were there large El Ninos? What was going on in the North Atlantic that might inform our understanding of this mode of atmospheric circulation variability known as the North Atlantic Oscillation. And so we were interested in these sorts of spatial features in the data, but as is often the case, it isn't necessarily what you find most interesting that others find most interesting. And what was by far emphasized most in this work was perhaps what I consider the scientifically least interesting aspect of the problem, which is what happens when you average over all that interesting spatial information and just get one number, the average temperature over the northern hemisphere. This is the reconstruction that we got when we did that, and it has indeed come to be known as the hockey stick reconstruction because of the overall shape of that reconstruction. There are sizable uncertainties, as you can see from the gray shading. But given the uncertainties that we estimated, we felt fairly comfortable in concluding that the recent warming was indeed anomalous in the context of at least the past 1,000 years, even taking into account those rather substantial uncertainties. Now, given the prominence that this particular piece of work received in the 2001 IPCC report, it was featured in the summary for policymakers, and it had become somewhat of an icon by that time of modern climate change. And not surprisingly, it got a lot of attention, including in contrarian circles. It became a lightning rod for climate change contrarians because of the fairly compelling message it appears to tell us about the nature of human climate change. This is from an op-ed in some newspaper in Canada, I believe. Okay, well, 10 years later, where do we stand? This is adapted from a plot that appeared in the most recent IPCC report, and now there's no longer a hockey stick. There's a hockey team, if you will. There are more than a dozen of these sorts of reconstructions, independent reconstructions, using different methods, different types of proxy data that have been performed now over the past spanning even more than the past 1,000 years. And they don't agree on all of the details, but one thing that is common to all of the reconstructions that have been performed is that the recent warming does indeed stand out as anomalous in the context of the millennium or slightly longer than millennial period over which these reconstructions are available. Now, as I said, and we ourselves have refined our work. There are far more extensive networks of these types of proxy data available, in fact, spanning almost the past 2 millennia. And so we have indeed followed up on our original work. We've published new reconstructions. We compare them with all the other reconstructions that have been performed. And essentially, we continue to see the same message, the same conclusion, that the recent warming is indeed anomalous. In a long-term context, as far back as these sorts of reconstructions can be performed, even given the fairly sizable uncertainties. Now, what can we learn about the physics of the climate system from this sort of work? As I've alluded to, I think that just looking at an average temperature over the globe or the northern hemisphere gives us limited insight. There are some insights that we can gain from that. For example, what's shown here is some of these reconstructions of the northern hemisphere temperature spanning more than the past 1,000 years with an array of climate model simulations, climate models that have been forced with the natural factors, explosive volcanism, changes in solar output that we know to be important over this time frame, and of course the anthropogenic forcing of recent centuries. And the models are able to reproduce within the uncertainties the histories suggested by these proxy reconstructions. And in fact, if you leave out the anthropogenic forcing, then you can't explain the modern rise. And so to some extent, we can use these sorts of reconstructions of average temperature over the globe or the northern hemisphere to, in a sense, validate our climate models. But I want to sort of return to this theme that a lot of the more interesting physics is actually in the spatial patterns that tell us about climate dynamics. And in fact, as I will argue, are provide us far more important insights into some of the aspects of projected future climate change that might most affect civilization and our environment. Now, this here is a recent result. It's using that same network of proxy data with which we've reconstructed the average temperature of the northern hemisphere, but this is actually showing the underlying spatial patterns that arise from these reconstructions. This is literally hot off the press. I received the galleys yesterday, and this will be appearing in Science in a couple weeks. What this shows is the estimated average pattern of surface temperature anomalies relative to a late 20th century baseline, so sort of relative to recent temperatures. The cold colors are colder than recent temperatures. The warm colors are warmer than recent temperatures. That is, temperatures over the past few decades. This shows the pattern of the so-called medieval climate anomaly. That's that period where northern hemisphere temperatures were relatively warm, although not as warm as the present, according to the reconstructions. And it has an interesting spatial pattern to it. We see, for example, that there's a large region in the North Atlantic and parts of Greenland and other areas in the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere where temperatures during this interval of, say, 950 to 1250 AD were, in fact, as warm or maybe even warmer than today. But what we find is that there are other regions like the tropical Pacific which were actually a lot colder than today. In fact, in the tropical Pacific, if you look at what's going on there, it looks like a very strong La Nina event. And so we had La Nina-like conditions persisting over several centuries. Now we go forward to the so-called Little Ice Age. Overall, the climate is cooler at this time by more than a half a degree. There are some regions which actually were at that time nonetheless relatively warm. We don't see that strong La Nina cooling during this time interval, and we see the heaviest cooling over the interiors of the northern hemisphere continents. So, well, once we have these spatial reconstructions, we can do some interesting things. We can average over particular regions to form climate indices that tell us how, well, this is just the average temperature of the northern hemisphere. This is the average temperature over the North Atlantic, sometimes called the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. The average temperature over the North Pacific, sometimes called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And this is the average temperature over the Niño 3 region of the tropical Pacific, which is often used as a metric of the El Niño phenomenon. What the reconstructions show is that, indeed, as the spatial pattern we looked at before suggests, this medieval era was a fairly strongly La Niña-like state of the climate. Comparatively speaking, the Little Ice Age was more in the El Niño direction, more in the positive direction. Well, let me shift gears just a little bit and talk about an interesting application of these reconstructions. This relates to independent work that I've done in recent years, trying to model the year-to-year variations in Atlantic tropical cyclone numbers. We know that Atlantic tropical cyclone counts are influenced greatly by sea surface temperatures over the main development region of the tropical Atlantic during the late summer, early fall. They're strongly influenced by the El Niño phenomenon. An El Niño year is unfavorable for tropical cyclone formation in the tropical Atlantic, while a La Niña year is relatively favorable, and that has to do with the influence on the large-scale circulation and the atmospheric shear in the tropical Atlantic, where these storms form. The more shear in the atmosphere, the harder it is for a tropical cyclone to develop. And also this North Atlantic oscillation phenomenon I referred to before, it's essentially a measure of the year-to-year fluctuations in the position of the northern hemisphere jet stream over the North Atlantic sector. So we form a statistical model based on a sort of fancy sort of multivariate regression called Poisson regression, which is appropriate for modeling things that are discrete, like tropical cyclone counts. And what we do is we train that statistical model over half the record, and then we predict the other half that we didn't train the model over, and then we reverse the roles of the two halves of the time series. And we find in these sorts of cross-validation experiments that we can resolve about 50% of the year-to-year variability in Atlantic tropical cyclone numbers based on these three factors and this tool of Poisson regression. Well, given that we have this statistical model that conditions tropical cyclone counts on various key climate indices, and we do in fact have reconstructions of those climate indices, as I discussed before, in particular, main development region, sea surface temperatures, Niño 3, and a shorter time period for the North Atlantic Oscillation, although it turns out that's the least significant of these three factors. We can use that same statistical model, and we can drive it with the paleo reconstructions. What I'm showing here is a comparison only over the modern interval. The red curve is the historical record of tropical cyclone counts in the North Atlantic. The black curve is the statistical model, and the gray is its 95% confidence interval. The green is an average of a set of what we call overwash deposits. These are deposits left behind from tropical cyclones, and in particular from hurricanes, that are available along the east coast of the U.S., in the Gulf Coast, and in the Caribbean. And one can take these records and form a sort of composite of them and try to estimate variations in tropical cyclone activity in past centuries. And it turns out that these sediment records are also available more than 1,000 years back in time. So what we did was to drive our statistical model with the paleo reconstructions to also compare with what the sediment records were telling us. Here is the modern comparison. I've simply squeezed in what's shown here, and now we're going to look at the variations in the past based on the green is the composite of overwash sediments. The blue is our statistical model forced with climate reconstructions. You can also see their uncertainties. The shaded and the two dashed curves are showing us the respective 95% uncertainty intervals in the two estimates. They don't agree on all the details, and there's some interesting discrepancies. And in fact, the discrepancies may be telling us more than the agreement about what factors are and are not important when you compare, say, landfalling hurricanes versus total basin activity. Those aren't quite the same thing. But we did see consistent evidence for an interval of high tropical Atlantic cyclone activity about 1,000 years ago that within the uncertainties is comparable to the modern interval of high tropical cyclone activity. And it turns out in the statistical model, this is coming from a combination of those La Nina-like conditions in the tropical Pacific, which are favorable to tropical cyclone formation, and the relatively warm sea surface temperatures in the tropical Atlantic. Okay, well, let me go back to those spatial patterns that I showed before, and I'm simply going to difference them. This now is an estimate of the medieval climate anomaly relative to the Little Ice Age. So it's the difference between the two. It's how much warmer in any one region the medieval climate anomaly period was than the Little Ice Age. So what it does, it takes the modern time interval out of the comparison. We're just looking at the difference between the MCA and the LIA. And indeed, the globe was warmer at that time. The Northern Hemisphere was warmer. Most regions were warmer during that medieval climate anomaly, particularly in the higher latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere over North America and over Western Eurasia, is where those are two of the regions where we see the greatest warming in the medieval era relative to the Little Ice Age. But there you see, relative to the Little Ice Age, the medieval era was cold in the tropical Pacific. It was La Nina-like, which is sort of interesting. Well, we know that El Nino has an important role in the year-to-year variations in our climate and influences weather patterns around the world. As I said, it influences tropical cyclone activity in the North Atlantic, and so it's pretty important to understand how it's going to change in the future. This is showing results, again, from that CMIP-3 ensemble that Carl talked about. These are the IPCC models, and showing where they stand with regard to the question of will anthropogenic climate change lead to a climate that is more El Niño-like or more La Niña-like. And they don't agree on that question. These are 20 or so state-of-the-art coupled global climate models, and they don't agree on a question as simple right now as what happens to El Niño, either in terms of the mean state, does the climate look more El Niño-like or does it look more La Niña-like? Now, the vertical axis is telling us, do the models predict that individual El Nino events and La Nina events become larger, or do they become smaller? And there's even greater disagreement on that latter question. It turns out that this relates to some of the uncertainties that Dorothy talked about and that Carl talked about, the uncertainties in how we represent clouds in the climate models. It turns out it's very important to get the intertropical convergence zone over the tropical Pacific right if you want to model El Nino. And to get that right, you've got to get marine stratocumulus clouds right, and that remains a very large uncertainty right now, modeling the response of clouds to anthropogenic forcing. So that's not a settled question, what happens to El Nino in the future. On the other hand, the paleo observations might be able to, I would argue, provide some insight into the answer to that question. What I've shown here is a comparison. I won't go through all the details. The blue are coral records from the tropical Pacific that tell us for certain periods where those corals, those fossil corals, can be recovered. So two periods sort of in the medieval, this period in the medieval era, this sort of intermediate period, and this period in the Little Ice Age. This was work published by Kim Cobb, who also, in fact, is a Yale alumna. She was a Yale undergraduate who did her senior research with Jeff Park and has now gone on to be one of the leading paleoceanographers. She's at Georgia Tech, an excellent candidate, by the way, for a future alumni event. Those corals tell us that, indeed, the medieval era, at least where we have coral records in that era, was relatively La Nina-like, sort of intermediate here, and the Little Ice Age was relatively El Nino-like, agreeing with the observations that I showed you earlier. Moreover, we reproduced those changes using a model known as the Kane-Zeebiak model. It's a model of El Nino. It doesn't know about most of the globe, but what it does know about the tropical Pacific Ocean and atmosphere, it does very well. It reproduces the wave phenomena in the atmosphere and the ocean that we know are important in the El Nino phenomenon, which aren't necessarily that well captured in the global coupled models. So we might not necessarily dismiss the predictions of a simpler model of this sort over those of the general circulation models. And indeed, the Kane-Zeebiak model does reproduce that La Nina-like medieval era and that El Nino-like Little Ice Age, and it turns out it does so because of something known as the tropical Pacific thermostat. And I won't go into the details. I'd be happy to talk with people who are interested in that later. But essentially, the tropical Pacific sort of reacts oppositely to what you might expect based on purely thermodynamic considerations because of the very same feedbacks, the Bjerknes feedbacks that govern El Nino. They respond potentially in a somewhat non-intuitive manner and actually give you a La Nina-like response to a positive radiative forcing, like the positive radiative forcing we had in the medieval era due to relatively high solar radiance and relatively few volcanic eruptions, or potentially to increase greenhouse gas concentrations, which is a long-wave radiative forcing of the same sign. Finally, I'm going to wrap this up. I don't want to drag this on too long here. This is that difference pattern I showed you from our reconstructions before. This is the same difference pattern from two global coupled models, the NASA GIS Model E that Dorothy talked about, subjected to those same radiative forcings, the radiative forcing differences between the MCA interval and the LIA interval. And this is a simulation of the NCAR-CSM 1.4 coupled model. Neither of those models reproduced the La Nina-like medieval era. We sort of knew that beforehand that would be the case because neither of those models reproduced that tropical Pacific thermostat mechanism. But those models that do reproduce that thermostat mechanism would likely reproduce that La Nina-like cooling. That just wasn't true of the two simulations that have been done for the past 1,000 years that we had access to. But what is interesting is that one of these two simulations, the NASA GIS simulation, does reproduce that enhanced warming over North America and northwestern Eurasia. It reproduces that quite nicely. In fact, it gives exactly the same global mean temperature change between the MCA and the LIA as the reconstructions do, but it also reproduces that pattern of enhanced warming over North America and parts of Eurasia. And it does that because the model responds with the positive phase of that so-called North Atlantic Oscillation I talked about before. Basically, a deepened Icelandic low, a stronger Bermuda Azores high, that leads to a strength in the westerly winds over the northern hemisphere in the winter, which ends up warming the continents in the regions that we're looking at here and here. The NCAR model doesn't reproduce that response in atmospheric circulation, and it doesn't reproduce the high latitude temperature changes we see in the reconstructions. So this appears to be telling us the paleoclimate data seem to be telling us that the mechanism active in this model, which has to do with some fairly complex atmospheric dynamics and how they respond to changes in ozone concentrations in the stratosphere, which are influenced by changes in solar output and change the thermal structure, the vertical thermal structure of the atmosphere in a way that influences planetary waves. I don't have time to go through the mechanisms, but there's a mechanism that's active in this model, which is also relevant to anthropogenic climate change, that seems to reproduce what we see in the observations. The North Atlantic Oscillation, by the way, this change in atmospheric circulation over the northern hemisphere in winter, as Ron Smith alluded to previously, has a very strong influence on rainfall patterns in the winter in the Middle East, for example. So if we want to know if anthropogenic climate change will exacerbate the water resource problem in the Middle East or attenuate it, we need to know how the North Atlantic Oscillation pattern will respond. The paleoclimate data may be giving us some additional hints about what the nature of that response is. Finally, I'll just point out, I don't have time to talk about it, what I've described so far is sort of the forwarding model problem, a forward modeling problem where you take climate models, you take the estimates of radiative forcings, drive the models with those radiative forcings, you look at some estimate of observations and compare the two to try to draw a conclusion as to whether the model physics seems to be capturing what we see in the real world. Another approach, which is similar in essence to the way we assimilate meteorological data into numerical weather forecasting models, is called data assimilation, and we do the same thing that we do with weather forecasting with proxy data. We assimilate the proxy data into a climate model, and we see what the model has to do to reproduce the proxy data or the information stored in the proxy data. And in this particular study, what we showed was that you can reproduce a period of natural 15th century Arctic warming that is apparent in the proxy observations in the model if you produce a certain change in atmospheric circulation that's consistent with that temperature pattern. And that's the change in atmospheric circulation. It's the 800 millibar level, but it's sort of telling us about how the sea level pressure patterns were changing in that model. So I'll leave it with my conclusions. Thanks.